Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We continue counting down to the Crop Consultant Conference. That's coming up in segment three today, but we start today with Taylor Talstrom and our Walnut Wednesday report.
This segment was sponsored by the California Walnut Board.
Hi, welcome to My Ag Life. Today we're talking with Davin Noreen, walnut grower and manager with Noreen Ranches, about the new UC Davis walnut variety Wolfskill's effectiveness as an early season variety. Welcome, Davin.
Good afternoon, Taylor.
Great to have you today. Davin, my first question for you here, can you tell me a little bit about your operation? You know, how many acres do you grow and where is the orchard located?
Yeah, so it's family operation that I primarily work on. We have about 800 acres of walnuts, about 600 that are mature in full production. We're located in Rio Oso. I manage and consult on some other properties, and it's all located very central in Rio Oso. Rio Oso is in the southern end of the Sacramento Valley. 35 miles north of Sacramento. We're located on the east side of the Feather River, near the confluence of the Bear River and the Feather River. So I would characterize our location as a relatively cool climate for the walnut, the Central Valley walnut growing region. We're fairly close to the Delta. We get fairly warm temperatures, high 90s, 100 through the peak summer months. But we typically always cool off to low 60s or sub 60 at night because we do get quite a bit of Delta breeze influence.
Davin, let's talk about Wolfskill here for a sec. What initially drew you to planting Wolfskill in your guys' walnut orchards? You know, what attributes of that variety stood out to you guys?
Yeah, so since we've been involved with the plant breeding program, the walnut improvement program at Davis, we've been, you know, looking for a replacement early season variety, one that would have a higher value than our current early season varieties, and also one that wasn't so susceptible so readily infected by walnut blight.
Can you tell me a little bit for a second about your partnership with the Walnut Improvement Program? Did they provide those trees for you guys? Was there an incentive for you?
Yes, the tissue came from the Walnut Improvement Program at Davis. There's no incentive other than just collaborating and working with the university and trying to help the industry. I mean, the greatest incentive is just learning, you know, seeing what's coming next to the industry.
Davin, you talked about earliness a little bit already, but, you know, Wolfskill, you know, earliness is its greatest attribute. How is an earlier harvest beneficial for a grower's expenditures?
Yeah, it's definitely one of its key attributes. Being early allows us to extend our harvest over a longer period of time. Currently with the heritage varieties, if you will, that we have, we'd start harvest in early to middle September, and it would extend all the way to the 1st of November. As we start replacing those heritage varieties, we've been left with only two or three primary varieties in the middle of the season, and that doesn't let you capture the full capital investment or utilize it the best if you're trying to smash everything into a 4 week period versus an 8 week period.
The earlier harvesting aspect of it has maybe an effect on yields. I'm curious, since Chandler still makes up a lot of the acreage in the state of California, how do Wolfskill's yields compare to Chandler or maybe some of the other popular varieties?
Yeah, I'd say their Wolfskills yields are similar to Howard from what we've seen so far. That being that they show a tendency, at least in our location, to have greater yields earlier than Chandler does. Chandler does very well, but takes a year or two longer to get fully mature, established yields as compared to Howard. Wolfskill seems to be more on the front end, where you're going to start seeing higher tonnage, really in those in that fifth and sixth leaf.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors.
The Crop Consultant Conference returns live in person on September 16th and 17th in Visalia, California. Co-hosted by Progressive Crop Consultant Magazine and the Western Region Certified Crop Advisors Association, this must-attend conference features 2 days of educational seminars, a live trade show, and honorariums and scholarships given by Western CCA, including the CCA of the Year Award. Hear the top experts in their field speak on pest management, artificial intelligence and new technologies, as well as the latest on soil health, nitrogen, and irrigation management. DPR and CCA credits will be available over the 2 days. For more information on credits, topics, and registration, visit progressivecrop.com/conference. Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you. The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow.
Hi, we're back talking with Davin Noreen, walnut grower and manager with Noreen Ranches, about the new UC Davis walnut variety Wolfskills effectiveness as an early season variety. Davin, how does Wolfskill stack up against some of the other early season varieties specifically that have come out of the walnut improvement program, you know, in terms of things like blight and chill resistance?
Yeah, one of the reasons we like it is it seems to be less susceptible or have more tolerance to blight. I do see incidences of blight in our trees, which are 7 years old now, but it seems to be very treatable with our commercial standard sprays. It's been better than some of the other early varieties that have come out of the Walnut Improvement Program. It also shows very good color, very good beet yields. Colors can be similar to Chandler. Meat yields up there in the 50+ percent range.
Talking about the blight resistance, how Wolfskill does have a higher resistance, you know, during the season, how does that really affect a grower's bottom line in terms of cost, you know, maybe compared to some of these other trees that don't have that high of a resistance?
Yeah, it definitely seems more tolerant. We get in trouble when we say resistant. But varieties that you don't have to spray as many times are going to be more give you a better profit margin or more wiggle room on the profitability side. A lot of our early varieties here in the Sacramento Valley, we're accustomed to spraying 6 or 7 times for blight starting in the middle of March and going into June sometimes. So spraying that often when you're achieving pretty low prices is kind of a double whammy. Wolf skill shows potential to be tolerant and also has kernel qualities to achieve more Chandler, Howard, Tulare like pricing.
Okay. Davin, I want to get in a little bit about your guys' rootstock choice for your Wolfskill acreage. You know, what rootstocks are you guys growing your trees on right now, and how have those performed thus far?
The seventh leaf Wolfskill that we have are planted on 4 different rootstocks. There's 5 trees on 4 different rootstocks, so 20 trees total. We used a Paradox seedling rootstock as one of the treatments. That was an in-house seedling that we produce on our ranch. And then we used the other 3 major clonal varieties that are available to the industry right now. So it's planted on Vlach, RX1, and VX211. It's performed well on and equally well without doing any measurements, just anecdotally looking at the canopy size, trunk size, yields. There doesn't seem to be any significant difference among any of the clonal rootstocks. Hasn't done as well on the Paradox seedlings. They're notably smaller and less vigorous than the clones.
Is there any maybe particular reasoning behind why the clonals are doing better than the seedlings?
Well, we anticipate that the clones that are available to the industry are superior to most Paradox seedlings that you find. We've done very well with this particular seed source over the course of planting it on our ranch. We have several hundred acres planted from this seed source. However, you know, that was the expectation with these clones, is that they should be superior to typical seedlings. But seedlings are also just one-offs, and it's only 5 trees, so there's really no statistical significance.
That is a good point. There wouldn't The number of trees would not be high enough to really test that theory. Maybe some other growers throughout the state have tested that a little further with the seedlings. But speaking to the bigger picture of Wolfskill in the state, I have one more question for you on that. Davin, do you have any other thoughts on the future of Wolfskill for the California walnut industry?
You know, new varieties are always a gamble. There is no sure thing. You do not know anything until you've had them in a commercial setting for 15, 20 years. That's really how long it takes to learn if you've got a winner or something that's really subpar. So it's a gamble. It's a risk. I would say that Wolfskill appears to be a risk worth taking at this point.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good sentiment there. You know, even I like the point you make where, you know, you do have to wait, but the attributes that it has, you know, presented itself with up to this point do seem promising, and they do have their benefits. So hopefully Wolfskill ends up getting people to increase the acreage, and it's just a better option as an early season variety for the walnut industry in the future.
Absolutely. That's all we can hope for is another tool for growers in our industry.
Definitely. Well, thank you, Davin, for coming on today and talking about Wolfskill. We hope to hear more about this variety from UC and anywhere else in the future. Hopefully good things. I appreciate you coming on today.
My pleasure, Taylor. I appreciate you having me.
This is Taylor with My Ag Life.
We will be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
The Crop Consultant Conference kicks off tomorrow at the Visalia Convention Center. As we continue previewing it, we have for you one of the sponsors, SQM.
My name's John Allen. I'm the Western North America Sales Manager for SQM North America.
All right. Well, let's start out. Tell me a little bit about SQM.
So SQM is at our core. We're a Chilean-based mining company. Our headquarters exists in Santiago, Chile. And we have mining rights in the northern portion of Chile, in the Atacama Desert. The Atacama Desert's the driest desert in the world. We're a global company. We have offices throughout the world. And our products as well are shipped throughout the entire world, North America, Asia, Europe, Australia, and obviously South and Central America. SQM, I mean, so we have two different divisions, we'll call it, for simplistic purposes. One is our industrial division. Our industrial division produces primarily lithium and iodine. I'm on the fertilizer side, and SQM is basic in the three main potassium sources, potassium chloride, potassium sulfate, and potassium nitrate. We consider potassium nitrate our bread and butter, and it's really what we're out talking about the most. We also do water-soluble NPK blends and have multiple production facilities throughout the world. And we also have an organic line as well.
So in your position, you cover a very wide territory. Tell me about some of the things that you encounter. Are there certain issues that growers or PCAs are seeing and they come to you for solutions?
Yeah, so I do cover a large area, and we kind of dabble in most states. My territory is west of the Mississippi. So, for example, in the Pacific Northwest, customers or potato growers in particular are looking for a product that's very, very soluble, which potassium nitrate is. In California, we see salinity issues. Potassium nitrate has a relatively low salt index, and it could also be blended with a lot of different materials. I guess a benefit of potassium nitrate is the fact that it is 100% available to the plant, whereas there are other K sources that may not be 100% available. So really, I think what we've seen in the West recently is adaptation of potassium nitrate in all three grades, the crystalline form, the prilled form, and the liquid form. And dealers or growers are liking the versatility and some of the things that they can do to it compared to other potassium sources.
So at the upcoming Crop Consultant Conference, your company is one of the sponsors, and I believe you're sponsoring a speaking session.
We are.
What is that topic going to be on?
The topic is basically going to be a non-commercial presentation based on potassium nitrate and its benefits, and how potassium nitrate can fit in virtually any fertility program. It's the presentation itself is, I'd say, more on a little on the technical side, but it also puts potassium nitrate in practice as well. We're going to talk a little bit about utilizing liquid potassium nitrate. We're going to talk about briefly salt index, solubility, the three different grades, as well as the versatility of just potassium nitrate in general.
So it sounds like there will be a lot of information for people to learn through that session.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, potassium nitrate's been used in western half of the United States for a while now, but it really has been in the shadows of other potassium products. And so my time with SQM has been basically educating growers and PCAs on the benefits of potassium nitrate. As again, I keep saying versatility, but we think the versatility portion of potassium nitrate is a great benefit. So really the presentations that we have created are based on educating folks, because a lot of growers, PCAs, aren't fully aware of potassium nitrate and its uses.
Will you also have a booth at the conference?
We will. We will. A large, hopefully an NCAP booth. Yep.
All right. So what are some of the things that you're hoping to talk with people about at your booth?
Again, it really goes back to education. A lot of growers still aren't familiar with potassium nitrate. There will be several of us in the booth. Our global agronomist will actually be in the booth as well. And his job really is education. And in the booth itself, I mean, we'll get probably some very specific questions on utilizing potassium nitrate in liquid form. That is definitely a new application that hasn't really been around for very long. And so that is where a lot of our conversations tend to lead, is using potassium nitrate in liquid form and injected in all crops across California.
We continue with our preview of the Crop Consultant Conference. Taylor Chalstrom is back to talk about a couple more sessions, those dealing with berry crops and cover crops.
Taylor, I understand that we have a researcher that you and I both have interviewed who will be doing one of our sessions. Tell me a little bit about it.
Yes, that man is Mark Bolda, who is a UC Cooperative Extension strawberry and caneberry farm advisor from Santa Cruz County. He'll be talking at the conference about managing fusarium in strawberries. This is one of the most recent talks that we added to the conference. What he'll be talking about is fusarium wilt, which is a growing as a major disease in strawberry. And so in this post-methylbromide era, you know, he wants to describe the disease, kind of discuss the identification and biology of the causal agent, which is Fusarium oxysporum, FSP frugaria, and finish by discussing current and potential management strategies for grower success going forward there. So I think it will shape up to be a really good talk.
I interviewed Mark on exactly this topic. I did an article for our Organic Farmer magazine. And I have to tell you, Taylor, he is one of my favorite people to interview because he is so enthusiastic about what he does. Have you found the same thing?
Yes, yes. Mark Bolda loves his job, and it's just like a really refreshing perspective. From a journalist perspective, to see that, you know, just how much detail he will provide about one little thing, one little aspect. And he only works with strawberry and caneberry. And so he still is just so, he loves it. And so, you know, if he loves it, then we love it. That's just kind of how it works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. He is the expert for strawberries and caneberries. Now, of course, fusarium, the topic that he's speaking on, is a major problem in strawberries and can be very difficult to manage. But he has had some very good advice, and you and I both have been able to report on that. You did a podcast with him, right? And I did an article.
Yes.
So people who want to know more about that after they go and hear him talk can also find more from our various websites as well. What day is he talking?
Mark will be talking on day two, which is September 17th. He'll be talking at 10:30 a.m.
And that's one where you should definitely bring like a notepad and some pens, because there will be things that you want to write down.
Yes, yes, there will. And I know specifically he will bring up the fact that there are tons of different types of fusarium fungi that exist but the one that causes this fusarium wilt in strawberry, this huge problem for growers, is just this one specific one. You know, a lot of I remember him mentioning a lot of different types of fusarium don't really affect strawberry that much, but it's just this specific one. And so you'll definitely want to hear about it.
You know, another thing that I was very interested in when I interviewed him was talking about prevention too, and everything that goes into preventing the spread of it, and how, you know, it is possible if you're very diligent and careful. So he always has a ton of good information.
Definitely, definitely. And I'm sure he'll be mentioning some of those prevention methods as well. A lot of them, you know, are these physical prevention methods, just from preventing it from entering the field in the first place. A lot of, like, you know, kind of disinfectant factors, and just generally being careful and, you know, studious in what you're doing.
All right. Thank you. Okay, Taylor, and you have one more that you wanted to talk about. What's the next session?
Yes, I do have one more. This session is about cover crops in California, and what we know, it's going to be a pretty general overview about cover crops. And that speaker will be Jessica Cantor, who is part of the UCCE Small Farms and Specialty Crops program in Fresno County. And she's conducted some trials in cover crops along with Shulamit Schroeder, who is also part of Cooperative Extension, and very knowledgeable about the subject.
So cover crops are a big subject right now. A lot of people talking about cover crops and different ways to use them in just in crop management, the benefits to the soils and using cover crops. So there's a lot of information that people want on this topic right now.
Yes, and it is kind of another one of those, you could say, controversial topics for a couple reasons, but, you know, there's a lot of research that has gone on in the past and is currently going on to further prove cover crops as benefits to growers, you know, like improving water infiltration and reducing nutrient loss, that type of thing. And it can also be used in an IPM setting for certain situations as well. A lot of the grower concerns surrounds kind of lack of rainfall to provide water to cover crops. In some orchard settings, cover crops, I've read from some of the UC researchers, have said that cover crops can use up quite a lot of water in the orchards. And, you know, that can maybe not be ideal in years of less rainfall. So you'll have to irrigate those cover crops and use more water. But Jessica has done actually a fair amount of research on cover crops, and her most recent project, I don't know if she'll be discussing it in her presentation, but her most recent project, when I spoke to her, showed that, you know, some cover crops can require little to even no water and still flourish in their biomass. And so there is a lot of promise in that regard.
Yeah. And we've had a couple of good articles in our Progressive Crop Consultant magazine on this topic too. In fact, that she, I believe, had written or submitted, that just, again, go to show some of the trials and some of the information. And so there is a lot to learn in this session.
Yes, there is a lot to learn. In that recent article that Jessica and Shulamit wrote, she talked about, you know, a couple of research trials that they did in the Southern San Joaquin Valley. And, you know, they looked at how well these different cover crop mixes suppressed weeds, how well they provided resources for beneficial insects, and again, also improved water infiltration. They got a lot of good data from there. It's a good read.
All right. And then when is her session?
Yes, Jessica's session is on day 2 at 11 a.m.
All right. Thank you, Taylor.
For more information, you can go to myaglife.com and click on the link in the top left corner. We'll be right back.
Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com. Agromayor Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromayor has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromayor can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
Don't let your soils become tainted and unproductive from excess salts. Take care of your crops while caring for your soil. Cation X5 Plus by AgroPlante is a soil conditioner meant to maximize water penetration by combating harmful salts in the soil, which can injure your crops and bottom line. Cation X5 Plus also corrects sulfur and calcium plant deficiencies. AgroPlante wants to help you grow your crop. Contact us today to find out more at 559-498-0388 or visit us at www.agroplante.com. Here's your news brief for today. President Joe Biden this week nominated Elaine Trevino for Chief Agricultural Trade Negotiator at the United States Trade Representative's Office. Trevino is president of the Almond Alliance of California and served as deputy secretary at the California Department of Food and Agriculture for Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and Governor Gray Davis. In the announcement, the White House states Trevino understands tariff and non-tariff barriers to trade and the importance of maintaining America's strong trade agreements and global positioning. Agriculture tax advisory firm Keiko Isom welcomed the proposed tax package that would draw previously suggested changes to the step-up in basis. While the legislation is far from the finish line and the proposal is far from final, Keiko's tax advisors noted that the proposed language includes changes that could significantly impact many farmers and ranchers. The firm says farmers and ranchers need to evaluate and address potential tax impacts before year end. Other changes in the proposed tax bill, including accelerating the reversion of prior estate tax rates and estate tax exemptions, will have the potential to affect farmers without adjustments. The pace of land sales picked up this year for National Farmers Company. The company reports it is on track for a near-record or record sales year on several fronts. The higher land prices have spurred an increase in number of landowners to sell, with some wanting to complete the sale before the year end due to uncertainty about those potential tax law changes. The question becomes whether the increased sale activity will continue into 2022. Competitive grant funding designed to support farm, food, and frontline grocery store workers affected by the COVID-19 pandemic will soon be available, Rod Bain reports.
For farm workers, meatpacker workers, and grocery store frontline workers who incurred expenses related to the COVID-19 pandemic.
While it's important for us to give recognition to these incredibly hard workers, I think it's also important for us to provide some level of support.
Which is why Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack recently announced $700 million in competitive grant funding to be available for pandemic-related health and safety costs for eligible workers.
I think it's important that we recognize that doing this essential work has also come not only at a potential physical risk, but also at a financial risk. Many of these workers have had to, out of their own pocket, pay for masks or personal protective equipment during the course of this pandemic. Some have had to take unpaid medical leave, whether it was to get vaccinated, whether it was to quarantine after coming in contact with somebody who had the virus, or perhaps it was because either a family member or themselves actually got sick.
Eligible applicants for these grants include state and tribal agencies and nonprofit organizations with a 501c3 status.
Now, this will include nonprofit foundations that are affiliated with a union or labor organization as well.
And to be eligible,
applicants must demonstrate experience in providing services to low-income migrant and seasonal farm workers, meatpacker workers, and frontline grocery workers.
The secretary offers examples of support that could include, but not necessarily be limited to,
entities that were providing personal protective equipment, such as masks, to ag and food workers, or entities that were hosting a vaccine clinic or an outreach campaign to encourage vaccination, or an entity that was providing financial support during COVID-19.
And in addition to applicants demonstrating support service experience,
applicants also have to be able to establish that they have the capacity to do outreach and technical assistance to get the word out to farm workers, meatpacker workers, and frontline grocery workers of the existence of this program, and that they're able to control these resources in a way that provides for efficient disbursement to eligible beneficiaries.
And of the $700 million in grants, $20 million will be used for at least one pilot program to support grocery workers and to test options for reaching them in the future.
We expect and anticipate the publication of the request for application to take place in the next couple of weeks.
A separate $700 million suite of pandemic safety and response grants was announced 2 days later, with the focus centered on small producers, processors, farmers markets, distributors, and seafood processors and vessels impacted by the pandemic. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Are consumers paying a fair price for meat products? Are farmers getting a fair price for their livestock? Gary Crawford has this report.
If you do the grocery shopping at your house, you know that grocery store food prices have been going up dramatically starting in the COVID year of 2020, but continuing this year. In 2020, grocery store food prices went up an average of 3.5%. Food price analysts thought prices would level off or even drop a little bit this year, now that the supply chain problems of 2020 have been smoothed out. But no, prices have continued to go up and could end up rising another 3.5% above last year. And if you keep track of your grocery spending, if you buy meat, you have also figured out that
about half of the overall increase in grocery prices can be attributed to beef, pork, and in poultry. And in beef and in pork, we've seen double-digit increases in prices over the last couple of months.
That's Brian Deese. He directs the White House National Economic Council. He and Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack held a press conference over at the White House the other day. You may ask why the White House is concerned about this. Brian Deese says, first, in the U.S. meat industry today,
the top four meat processors control 85% of the market.
So producers of cattle, hogs, and poultry have very little choice as far as selling their animals. So there's very little competition among the companies. Secondly,
the four top companies in these industries have seen record or near record profits in the first and second quarter of this year.
Thirdly, those companies have been paying livestock producers less for their animals. And fourth, consumers are still paying more. Last year, beef prices rose an average of over 9.5%. So far this year, retail beef's up another 6.5%. Pork prices last year jumping 6%. They're up right now by another 8% almost. So Brian Deese says we have four or five major meat processing companies controlling up to 85% of the meat market, making record profits while consumers pay more and livestock producers get less.
It raises a concern about pandemic profiteering.
Now, Brian Deese stopped short of using the phrase price gouging, and he would not venture an opinion on whether some of what's going on might be illegal, but he did go as far as to say,
these price increases that are affecting consumers are not happening in isolation, and that companies are making decisions to drive these price increases.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack told reporters, legal or not, the farmers who raise the cattle, hogs, and poultry are not getting a fair deal.
You know, it's not something we're dreaming up here. The profits are real. The fact that producers are not making a profit. I mean, I remember talking to a producer the other day in Council Bluffs, and he said, I don't get this, Mr. Secretary. He said, I just sold my cattle and I lost $150 a head, but the processor made $1,800 a head. How can that be?
So he says the administration is going to be taking several actions toward two main goals.
Goal number one is to make sure that farmers get a fair return for their efforts and their capital investment. And the second goal is to make sure that when consumers go to the grocery store and they're at the checkout counter, they get fair prices.
How to achieve those goals? A major topic of discussion last week at the first meeting of the President's Competition Council. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
The latest book from Feeding Minds Press, the Farm Bureau Foundation for Agriculture's publishing venture, helps children learn more about life on the farm. Michael Clements shares more.
The American Farm Bureau Foundation for Agriculture's Feeding Minds Press released its latest book Tuesday, connecting children to what life is like on the farm. Foundation Education Outreach Director Julia Recco says the book features a heartwarming yet true-to-life tale.
The new book is called Barn at Night, and it is by author Michelle Hout. And Barn at Night features a father and daughter as they work in the pre-dawn hours in their barn to feed and care for their animals, and is illustrated with wonderful watercolors from the very talented illustrator Jen Benton.
Recco says the book helps build awareness of agriculture through education.
One of the best ways and the most organic ways to help students learn is just through stories. And so books are an excellent vehicle for this kind of information. And especially with a lot of the pictures to help tell the story, kids are so visual. Books like Barn at Night really help young learners understand where their food comes from, who grows it, and how they grow it.
The book is available anywhere that books are sold.
You can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can order it from a local bookstore. You can also request it from your library. And we have educational resources and fun activities that accompany the book on feedingmindspress.com. You can also watch a video of the illustrator as she shows you how she researched the book and how she creates her amazing watercolors in the book.
Learn more at feedingmindspress.com. Michael Clements, Washington.
That's our show for today. If there's a topic you'd like to hear more about, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.